Paranormal and say that this is November 5th, 1987, and I'm with Mildred Cunningham McHenry, is that right?
Right.
And we are in, what do you call this community here?
This is a Bulltown community, but it's where you are is on, you're at the McHenry home on Millstone Road, which is the old Weston and Golly Turnpike. This road that you came up here on is the old Weston Golly Turnpike.
Is that right?
That's right. Right on beyond here, they have, the Corps owns a great deal of it, and it will join the two dams. I mean, Burnsville Dam and the Stonewall Jackson will be joined with walking trail or horseback trail whenever Stonewall is open, which is perhaps 88.
Uh-huh. And when did they shift the road from here to was this at one time Route 19?
Oh no, this wasn't Route 19. This was the first north-south highway across here in West Virginia, much the same as I-79 is today. Back in 1848 through 1858, they built 110 miles of road from Golly Bridge to Weston, which in both cases it met an east-west road. I don't have the particular names of them, but I guess that you could find that out. I have some notes even that I could look back and find that. But after the settlers had, see, the settlers followed the Indians. They were here first. And by the way, this is a Bulltown community, and it got its name from Captain Bull, which had been, he was a Delaware Indian. His father, T.D. Wison, was killed in New York, so he was the chief of the Delaware tribe. So I guess in passing down from generation to generation, Captain Bull would have been the next chief of the Delaware tribe, if that's the way they did their royalty. So he was trying to get revenge because of his dad being murdered or being killed. So he started out across New York, killing whoever got in his way, trying, you know, seeking revenge. So eventually he was captured along with several of his people. Now, they didn't shackle him, as history tells us, but he was such a wise person. And they became very suspicious of he and his people. So rather than have more bloodshed, they gave him a sentence of completely leaving New York. Now, the state, not just the city, the state of New York. So he headed south with five or six of his families. And so they didn't stop. They came on across. Of course, there was roads down to Philadelphia area and so on. And he came into West Virginia. There, of course, there were no doubt been people here before, like the Mound Builders and some of the other Indian tribes. But when he came into West Virginia, following Indian trails and the trails of the buffalo, elk, and so on, he found, he got into the Little Kanawha River area, found fishing was good. The animals were here. I mean, there was plenty of wildlife to feed them. And they set up shop over where the campground is, where the Corps built their campground. They don't like for me to tell that, but my husband used to work on the farm over there, and every time it was plowed, and I knew it before that even, every time they turned the soil, well, they found a lot more artifacts, you know. Of course, that over the years, they've disappeared more or less. Mm-hmm. And of course, now there's nothing being cultivated. Mm-hmm. But he was there, I don't know how many years, but he found salt in the saline springs that were along near the river. He started manufacturing salt because that was a commodity you didn't very well get along without. I mean, if you made, if you were out hunting, you may be out for days, and you had to have something that on you to eat. So that was a good way to have jerky or some of the, along with some of your other dried foods, but you had to have salt even to tan hides, to make teepees or clothing, shoes, whatever. I mean, moccasins, whatever. So they found enough salt and had become a pretty good, they devised a method that worked pretty well. They used logs over the springs, hollow logs, gum logs, to let the water come up in that, and then they put it in, split out half logs that were dug, like almost like a boat, and they would heat rocks, those big round river rocks, in a fire and put them in it. And they made enough salt for their own use, and when the early settlers began coming in here, they also traded them salt. I mean, that brought things into them that they needed too, because there wasn't a whole lot of anything that came in except on horseback or just being carried in by the Indians. So when the first pioneers came in, which were the Haymans, it was one of the first ones that decided to make salt. It was Colonel John Hayman, and my great-grandmother was part of that family. So they settled at Falls Mills and on down here to Bulltown. And at Bulltown, they put down a well. And, of course, it had to be a dug well. It wasn't one done with machinery. But they put down a salt well. And he went to Pittsburgh, went by way of the river down Kanawha, up Ohio to Pittsburgh, and ended up bringing back a lot of iron kettles. Fact is, when I was a kid, that was the kind of a kettle we heated our water in, was one of the old salt kettles, to, you know, for laundry and so on. So that was our boiling kettle. But they made salt then to trade, and in trading salt, their best market was at Clarksburg, but there was no road. It was, remember still, it was just back prior to 1848, it was just horseback. Lots of places wasn't even wide enough to get a wagon through. I mean, trees, this was a forest area, and this was the wilds of Virginia too, you know. So they saw the necessity. People were coming into the area. They saw the necessity for a north-south road. If you lived in the Sutton area, you used Elk River. That was your transportation. And Kanawha River, if you were in this section, you used the river. So salt was selling for 2.5 a bushel in Clarksburg. Doesn't sound like much now when we buy it by the pound, but that was a lot then in a way of income. So after they saw the necessity, and this Mr. Squires that lived over at Salt Lick Bridge and some of the other people got together and made a company, and they begun that road. They say it probably cost $400 a mile, but they followed ridges. Now, if you notice, 79 falls lowlands, just anything, I mean, cut off the side of a hill. They followed ridges and hilltops. Of course, they had to come off the creeks and ford a lot of creeks. They come to the Kanawha River and had to build a bridge. And actually, that was the only bridge between here and Glenville. The road was completed in 1858, which made it just right for the Civil War. That was already, you know, in the making by 1861. Of course, the Civil War was getting underway. That's when the fortification was made on the Cunningham Farm here. And the Cunninghams, the house is supposed to have been built by Henry Cunningham. Now, as far as my family, absolutely know on that for certain, I don't think they did. But the Corps has done some renovation work on it. And I've asked them, and they say, oh, we didn't find any dates or things. But I feel certain that they did find something somewhere in history, because they say that he built the house, which was my great great-great-grandfather, because it was my, I believe. Anyway, I may have one too many greats there. But he built the house, and it has always stayed in the Cunningham family. Thinking now back there that was prior, probably to 1848, that they were already down here in that particular house. It's still standing, and the Corps bought it in 1974. Although my sister was permitted to live there until 1983. So we were raised on stories. What happened? And I mean, it was a different life from what most kids even around here had, because all kids came, it was like a point where the other kids came. I mean, we had feather beds, we had that kind of thing. So when they came in there and took over The Union troops took over the house, a part of the house. The house actually is a dog trot fashion, but at the time of Civil War in 1861, the breezeway area was already built in. That was already two rooms, the downstairs room and the upstairs. With the stairway was rather, will that bother you? If you will, I'll go take it down.
Okay, you started to say that you were raised on stories.
Oh, yeah, raised on stories. I mean, that was, you got to think back a little bit. There was no TV, very few radios, and then we had the old battery that had to be charged. So you just really heard the Grand Ole Opry in the news. That was about it, because you couldn't afford to take that thing, have it charged, you know. It was almost a weekly thing, and it wasn't too satisfactory, but they got a lot of entertainment out of it. It was something that was kind of unusual to be able to hear something from the airway, but we heard a lot of stories. Like my great-grandfather, Moses Cunningham, that lived in a house with he and his wife and Phoebe and their five children. He was a Confederate at heart, although he wasn't a slave keeper. But some of the relatives, like Phoebe's family, they kept slaves, and that's how they got a lot of their work done. But I guess if you had the money to, you could buy slaves. It was not unheard of. I mean, there was quite a few in Braxton County. And but he was a Confederate, but it was like having the enemy on his territory. When they came in, they took over the ox and they took over his farm. And they, out where the fort area is, they had taken the oxen out there. When they came in to build their fort, they had to have it where they could guard the bridge. They didn't want the Confederates to go north or south, you know, either way on that bridge. They just wanted to keep them completely out of it. So he, being a Confederate himself, with his feelings, He didn't want them using his stuff. He didn't want them there, but that was their best location. So they took it. And my grandfather was just a young teenager, probably 14 or 15 years old. And that was Elias Haman and Cunningham. And he outdid his dad and went out and plowed the trenches because they were fighting the oxen, and he was very unhappy about it. So he plowed the trenches. The troops did the shoveling. And shoveled over the dirt, and it's still obvious that he did a real good job out there because the trenches are still very visible. And so he kind of defied his father, but it was one of those things that he felt was a necessity. And the troops were there. There was troops there in that for 4 years. That's a long time to have the enemy in your backyard or in your house. The house was used for the telegrapher office, which, you know, was the dits and dashes. And they had to have someone in there that could do that. And that was to take all messages. And they had the telegraph lines, you see, from Clarksburg, you know, telling where all else over the east here that they had those things. But they kept someone in there constant. And the fort had its own trenches and fortification, but down on each side, now out behind where they have the Catholic Church now, there was a set of trenches there, and they used that for target practice and used it for guard duty. And there was another one then. It was down along the old Weston Gully Turnpike Road that the Corps so far hasn't done anything about. I don't really think that they knew it was there, but I knew it was there because we used to play in it. We'd play up and down the road, you know. Instead of playing the road, we played up on the bank on our property and played in the trenches. Nobody ever knew we was up there. If we were out there playing, we could all drop in the trench and be gone, you know. Nobody ever knew we were there. Then they were going back and forth up and down the road, you know. Most of it was horseback or with a wagon, so we had fun because it was like playing war, I guess. Only we even played Indians, I don't know. But growing up on down there, we heard a lot of things, and we had things like we had the old shells that were few inches long, 3.5 or something like that. About the size of a Coke can, I always say. But we had three of those that were live. And in later years, back in 41, when they stone based, that was after the old wooden bridge had broke, seal had broke in it. So they had to have a right-of-way for an outlet year. And my uncle still owned his part of the farm at that time. So he said, I'll give you the right-of-way, providing you'll stone base it to the end of the farm. So that's he held him to it, and we got a mile of stone base road, which was, it was great for the people who had automobile, but it wasn't a bit good to walk on barefooted or, you know, for kids to play on because the sand and everything was gone, you know, because they'd stone-based the area. So when the bridge had to be replaced, well, we had to have a different outlet. But we would, as children, we would go on the hill when after a rain into any of the plowed fields. We would hunt for the mini balls and all this kind of stuff. But when they stone based that, and I was talking about the shells, those live shells, they put those, wrapped them in paper and put them in a metal box and buried them out in the garden because they was afraid, you know, the dynamite shots would put those things off. But sometime, it was after the Corps had bought the place, there was a group come in. I think they had found some questionable materials down there. They didn't know what they were, and they had the group come in to, you know, to see if it was dangerous. And I think it came from Cincinnati, from the, I don't know, the demolition group. But then my sister, she goes and brings out these shells, and they were leaking powder. And they took those away, and they were to return them because they belonged to the South. They were Confederate shells. They were to return them, providing they could empty them without blowing them. So, of course, they never came back. So whether or not they emptied them without blowing them, we can only assume that they blew them up because they didn't come back. And that was the one type shell that they had used there, and I knew of two of the big round ones, and because they were both doorstops in two different homes that had been plowed out, on one over on the Confederate side and one on this side. My uncle had it, and I don't know, but I would say that my cousin has it loaned to a museum in Pittsburgh because he has a lot of the things that his granddad had loaned to a museum in Pittsburgh. He has told me that he would bring it out here, providing they had some security, but there's no security out here. So, I mean, things he's got are valuable, very valuable.
Like what?
Oh, guns and whole works and a lot of hand tool things, you know. So he had quite a collection because he had the money till if something was available, you know, in the area, he could get it, which was not the way with our family. I mean, we had what was there. We didn't accumulate a lot more things. It was things that we had had all the time, you know. Or you found them by plowing them out. My dad plowed out a watch. It was a pocket watch, and it was beautiful, even on the outside, and it wasn't damaged so much, and I don't know, it must have been 50 years from the time of the war till he plowed it out, and it was engraved inside, had a gold dial, and the balance wheel was a solid gold balance wheel on it, and he took that to a jeweler, and they removed the dial, and he bought another pocket watch and had the dial put on his new watch. Oh, he was very proud of that watch because no one else had one like it. Of course, you know, those cases all closed, but the other one was engraved. Now, I don't know exactly which one of the members of the family has it, but I know the one that they had intended to be was my oldest sister's son to have it. I don't know whether he's got it or not. He should have it because it was intended for him. Mm-hmm. You know, fact is, there was no boys in our family. I mean, there was four girls. work was different on the farm as we were growing up because of the no girls. I mean, no boys, all girls. So the three other girls was pretty husky kids. So they got to be out with Pop and the team, you know, when they was farming and so on, and which made it good for them. They didn't have to do the chores around the house like I did, and I was the one that did the footwork because, you know, everything had to be carried to them, like water. And well, it was just a little different for me than what it was for them because I was little, awful little, and scrawny and poor, ribby, you know, just downright poor. Nowadays, someone would say she was starving, but it wasn't that. I ate as much as any of them, but I just didn't carry weight very good.
Did you say ribby?
Ribby, yeah.
That's a good term.
Oh, yeah, didn't you? Oh, yeah, a pup or something. It wasn't growing very good. They were always ribby. And someone's child, if they had two or three kids, and they were all, you know, filled out real good. And then here, this one, little old ribby one. Oh, I can remember when silk hose, when I first wore silk hose. Oh, I couldn't. I mean, they just, I didn't have enough legs to hold them. So they had a nickname for me then, but that was because of it. They knew a lady that wore them twisted all the time. So they always tormented me about that. But I got tormented a lot because I was little.
What did they call you?
No, it was a lady's name, and it was terrible. I mean, even anybody would remember her. It was awful. Now, I suppose we did have some colloquialisms, though. But in my family, in the Cunningham family, there were no middle names for girls. We had our first name and our last name. Fact is, when I named my two girls, they just have two names. And I said, you can take care of the middle one. I did. So they both carry the M for McHenry as their middle initial. And then everyone says, what's your middle name? And it, you know, it's their maiden name, so it's kind of unusual. Now you hear people with three or four names, and that child will never learn to spell them all. But that carries on back. My grandmother was the one that insisted that we girls only had a single name, but it carries on back through history that they only used one name. And of course, the girls could always picked up a second name if they married. So, in looking up on the genealogy thing, you find a lot of the repeats of names, and just a single name, even for the boys. So, it was. But then you found in the boys' name, in their name, you found, like the first boy that was named, carried his mother's maiden name on down. So you can chase history, and we've found a pattern in chasing Cunningham history. I didn't know whether everyone would or not.
Who would you hear the most from about when you heard things about the war? Would it be your grandfather?
Well, it was dinner table talk. If company, like my aunt would be home, or my uncle would be at home. Well, she worked for the railroad. She had taught school for a while after she finished eighth grade, you know, and took a few classes, you know, that they taught what they call a normal school. I don't know, it was like college classes taught for a couple of months in the summer or something like, probably longer than 2 months because school didn't last the regular school didn't last 10 and a half months like it does now. So when she would be home, and she was always digging into genealogy, and I mean, you go to the table to eat and you were hearing stories. And I can remember very well that we had company, and they were talking about my great-grandmother Phoebe. She had to keep her riding horse in the meat house, which was in the backyard. And it had dirt floor with the pit in the center where they built their fire to smoke the meat after they cured it on the shelves, you know, the table around the wall. I can remember the meat house even. Of course, I'm sure that it wasn't exactly like it had been in her time, but it was still just a rough-hewed, you know, rough boards that it was built out of. And it was square, but it was almost circular inside on account of the tables that went clear around the walls. And they put her horse in there. You went up a step and down a step. So at that time, they may have even had a stone step there or something different. They may have just filled it in with dirt so the horse could walk in and out. But they noticed one day that one of the troops was there taking her, one of the Union troops was there taking her horse. And of course, you know how you'd yell for Mom. So Mom went with a butcher knife and she cut the strap from right in front of his hand. And they said that she wouldn't have gotten away with it had he had a sidearm. But she put the horse back inside and didn't let him have it. But they had taken over everything. I mean, part of the house. I don't know how the family ever lived there. I really don't. Because, well, I guess the only reason why they could was the fact that war materials at that time are not the equivalent of what they are now. I mean, it was your rifles, mainly, was what they had. Of course, they had sidearms, just like those that were there in the room, the section of the house. No doubt, they had their sidearms and had the other rifles, too. But they no doubt kept her sidearm on or right handy. Because during there was a number of skirmishes along the road that they would talk about, you know, well, we had the bushwhackers where people organized to try to protect their own. Actually, I don't think it was that they wanted to be in favor of either side, but when either set of troops came in and was going to take over their animals, or, well, they stole so many of the cattle. They stole whatever they pleased. I mean, the hay, the feed, if they didn't get it by demand, or they had buyers that tried to buy it, and if they didn't get it, they took it. So those bushwhackers were out to get some of those people, and of course they were bushwhackers working in this area too. But they were local people. They had no doubt been organized by somebody, and they. But I've heard them talk about those, that you weren't safe in daylight, even, and that people tried to travel even then at night, you know, but. Light, unless you had a moonlight night or something like that, it was hard for you to travel. And if you tried to travel at night on a horse, they could hear you. So you weren't safe no way. But see, my great-grandfather was shot during the Civil War. And I've heard controversy about where, but anyway, he was shot in the back of the leg, hip, and or someplace. He was shot. He wasn't killed. The bone wasn't hit or anything, you know, didn't break a bone, but he cut a big shine, and I had never heard the quote that he had given. I did know that he yelled hooray for Jefferson Davis and was shot, but he had to be shot by the man that was in the guardroom there in the section of the house, because he is on the porch, and he was shot by one of the Union troops, so he had to be shot right there. So it was the one out, whoever was in there at the particular time. So they took him prisoner. Of course, the quote that they have, I still have not. I didn't, never heard that as a kid. But they're using it down here at the center. But I didn't hear it. And the first time I heard it read down there, I said, "Who was that?" And
What are they using?
Oh, it said that they were taking him. They took him prisoner because after he was shot, he was cutting such shine. And let's see, it was "Hark the Tune." They were taking him to the Union trenches, the fort. And they said, "Hark the tune, a doleful sound." Anyway, he wanted him to come and look at the ground where the Yankees would soon lie. So where your blankety-blank Yankees would lie. Well, in other words, he was Confederate right on through. He didn't give up. And my people were, part of them turned into fur buyers and trappers and that kind of thing. They weren't the people that came and settled in the cities and stayed there. They were explorers. It came on in. They were surveyors. My grandfather was a surveyor, and his son was a surveyor, and that son's son a surveyor. And they were business people. They worked when we had county offices, you know, to be filled. They were in the county offices. So we got a lot of information that a lot of people, you know, didn't get, because they came by to see what they could find out, you know, and business was talked. But now, us kids didn't sit around and wait for the business to be talked, because we weren't allowed to. That was confidential, actually. And you went on about your business, and they did what was necessary to talk about. So it made great politicians out of some of them, although they didn't run for offices. They were in appointed offices. You about to run out of tape here?